This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rabkin. First Draft highlights the voices of writers as they discuss their work, their craft, and the literary arts. My guest who joined me via Skype is Laila Abolela. She is the author of novels, a short stories, and several radio plays. Her novels include The Translator, Minaret, Lyrics Alley, and The Kindness of Enemies. Abolela grew up in Khartoum, Sudan, and now lives in Aberdeen, Scotland. She writes about being a cultural outsider, Islam, Sufism, history, identity, and political issues. We began by discussing the plot of her latest novel.
The Kindness of Enemies is set in two time periods. One of them is present-day Scotland, where we follow the life of a researcher who is half Sudanese, half Russian. And she's interested in the life of Imam Shamil, who's a 19th century warrior who fought a resistance against Russian imperial expansion. And so the novel goes back and forth between her life in the present and his life in the 19th century. Her life is not very particularly exciting, except that her favorite student gets arrested on terrorism charges while she's visiting his home where she's staying because she gets stuck in the snow. But most of the action actually in the book takes place in the country. That follows Imam Shamil's 8-year-old son was kidnapped from him by the Russians. And he grew up away from him in the palace of the Tsar of Russia as the Tsar's godson. And so Imam Shamil tries very hard to bring him back. And he's unable to do that until he's a princess. And he exchanges her for his son.
How did you, alight on this plot? What was the impetus for you to write about this? What was your inspiration?
Well, my inspiration was the Imam Shamil himself. And I was really touched by how he lost his son, the fact that his son got kidnapped at such a young age, and how the son grew up so far away from him under a completely different culture. And then the son facing the need to return to his father.
And did you have any questions that were nagging at you that you wanted to explore? Because obviously this is a fictional account. In terms of the emotions or the setting or what was really exciting for you to dive into?
Well, it was the sense of being torn away from, where you grew up, and also the father's feeling that his son is being brought up differently than him, and how he's kind of lost him physically, not only physically, but also emotionally and really. That kind of the nerve with me, because of course I left Sudan when I was in my 20s and I moved to Scotland, and it was a big move for me, and I kind of never got over it in a way. And a lot of my writing explores this idea of moving from one place to another and having a sense of being of belonging to both places.
So his son was Jamal al-Din, and he was kidnapped at 8 years old, and he grew up in this palace of the Tsar. And it was a very different life when you went between how you saw how Shamil and his wives lived and then Jamal al-Din, because it was really a life of austerity with the Sufis, and with the Russians it was sophistication. And Jamal al-Din, because he was so young when he was kidnapped and grew up in the Tsar and he was loved there, he was exposed to arts and culture and dance and women and good food and all these things. And when, later when he was an adult, and when Shamil kidnapped Anna as part to get his son back, his son kind of felt like he didn't belong anywhere. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, his son didn't feel like he belonged anywhere. It's a sharp, sharp contrast. I mean, Shamil and his family live up in the mountains. It's very austere. It's all that, even the houses are made of stone. They don't have furniture. They just sit on the ground. The food is very basic. You know, there's no such thing as entertainment. And basically, his son Jamal, growing up, which I used Anna Karenina, Tolstoy's novel, to research it, because that was the same time period. So it's a huge difference. You know, there's, as you say, there's balls, there's, you know, it's really a life of grandeur. And he was an officer in the Russian army and you know, of the Tsar. So there was a lot of, he lived a life of privileges. And there was the horse racing, and there was the ice skating, and there was, the, you know, the operas. And so all these things were very much in sharp contrast to the life he had grown up with.
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest who joined me via Skype is Laila Abolela, author of The Kindness of Enemies.
So you also had another example of a similar situation where you have a foreigner in this land, and that's with Anna. So as the war went on, and it's all about land and territory and who's going to get, you know, what for their people, when Shamil was sort of at wit's end with trying to get his son back and needing some advantages in the war against the Russians, he kidnaps Anna in Georgia and brings her back to where he lives. And she's there for, I think, 9 months.
Yeah.
When she's there, he does try to treat her nicely, tries to treat her as he does his other wives. Can you talk about her role in this book and her there?
She's a character for me. Her journey is very traumatic, you know, being kidnapped from her home. She's carrying a baby, and she's got her son with her. And then they're driven up the mountains. And that is quite horrific. And it was very vivid for me, this journey up the mountain, and I hope it was in my head, you know. And then when she gets up to the mountain, she's told that she's not, you know, the usual prisoner of war. Instead, she's going to be housed in Imam Shamil's own personal, you know, compound with his wives. You know, one of them doesn't like her, but the other two do. And so she has, you know, different relationships with the different women. And quite a lot of part of the book is her kind of bonding with these women whom she would never have met usually in her social circumstances, you know, and the fact that they do become friendly towards each other, and they do learn from each other, so that, you know, she's a changed person after this experience.
And were you brought up Muslim?
I was brought up a Muslim, and I'm a practicing Muslim myself. And I always try, you know, in my writing to bring Islam into the writing that I'm writing, because I'm very conscious when I'm reading. I mean, I love English literature, and when I read English literature, I'm very much influenced by Christianity. So so as you know, as an African, and as a I'm a, you know, other, you know, African writers have spoken of how they grow up as children reading books from the West, and they feel the cultural differences, how, you know, the characters are eating strawberry, and you growing up, I have no idea what a strawberry is. So I feel that way as well. But then in addition, I've also been very conscious of how Christianity is pervasive in English literature. Huge differences, you know, growing up as a Muslim. For example, one of my favorite novels is Jane Eyre, and of course in Jane Eyre the problem, or the obstacle between Mr. Rochester and Jane getting married is the fact that Mr. Rochester is secretly married to Bertha, you know, the mad woman in the attic, and he can't get a divorce from her. And so, of course, as a reader, I'm totally, you know, behind Jane, and I'm totally you know, immersed in her conflict, but also a part of me as a Muslim, I think, well, why can't he can under, for example, Sharia law, he could very well divorce Bertha and marry Jane, or he could marry both of them at the same time. So you then can't help, your brain can't help thinking that as you are reading. If I'm in Austin, for conscious laws of inheritance are very different in Muslim Sharia law, which gives women the right of inheritance. So a lot of the plots in Jane Austen's novels, you know, revolve around the fact that these daughters don't inherit their father, or that the inheritance isn't divided equally between the different firstborn's inheritance. And in Islam, all the sons get an equal share, and the daughters get an equal share as well. So and the wife, gets a share as well. So you know, that's how I see English literature. And so when I'm writing myself, I bring in, you know, this culture, my own culture, into it, and I'm very conscious of doing that.
I mean, you did have to take a hard look at Islam and Christianity. I'm just wondering if, as you were going between Islam and Christianity, or even highlighting some of the difficult parts of Islam, if that was hard.
Well, not as hard. I mean, the same for any other writer, who for them their own culture or their own, you know, religious culture is just part of their life, part of their upbringing. It's not hard. It's just, to me, this is it's just a natural, and it's just I think what is hard is keeping it being not conscious that the reader is different, or that the reader might have prejudices, for example, against Islam or so on. I have to not be defensive. I have to not be looking over my shoulder when I'm writing. You know, I have to be not consistently answering back, defending or apologizing, or, you know, justify to make the story natural within its natural context. You know, the way Christian writers wrote without even feeling that, without a self-consciousness, that I don't think Charlotte Bronte, who was a practicing Christian, for example, felt a kind of self-consciousness about being a Christian, and yet there's a lot of Christianity in Jane Eyre. So that's how I feel about it. Yeah.
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest who joined me via Skype is Laila Abolela, author of The Kindness of Enemies.
So one of the things that tied the older story of Shamil with the modern day story was a sword. So he had this famous sword that he had, that this family, so your narrator is Natasha, that Oz, her student, and his mom, Melek, own. Can you talk about the sword?
Yeah, the sword is what brings Natasha to visit Melek in the first place. So that's really much how the novel starts, with her as this lecturer giving a talk about Imam Shamil, who's her, you know, the subject of it. And her favorite student tells her that he's actually descended from Imam Shamil, and that his mom has the sword at home, and would she like to come and see the sword? And so she does come and see the sword at home. And one of the things that happened while she's visiting is that, and she's stuck there for, you know, 2 days is this student who's called Oz. Actually, his real name is Osama, but he prefers to be called Oz. And he uses the sword. He builds snowmen and chops off their heads with his sword. And his mom says to him, "This is a very ancient sword. Why are you disrespecting it?" And this is kind of, for me, was sort of symbolic of this whole way that jihad has become, completely twisted and used by terrorists to justify, you know, their terror and the injustice that they do. And then they call it jihad in the name of Islam. But actually, the jihad, the real the jihad, was the kind that was practiced by Imam Shamil, in the sense that it was in self-defense, that it had rules, that it didn't, you know, it wasn't targeting civilians. It wasn't about destruction. It was about defense. And it also, at the end of his life, after Imam Shamil, after practicing jihad and fighting the Russians for many, many years, he surrendered. He didn't blow himself up. He didn't commit suicide. He surrendered to the Russians. He handed in his sword. He was taken to exile in, and he came into contact with Russian culture. He was admiring of the Russians. You know, he admired their compassion. He admired the technology that they had. He admired, you know, Russian culture. He was able to make his peace with his enemies. You know, so real jihad, you know, modern warfare has, you know, guidelines and has restraints and has restrictions, and it has an end as well. It ends in peace. There can be peace. There can be reconciliation. But what we see nowadays now with the terrorism, that it doesn't have an end, and it's vindictive. It's, you know, it just goes on and on. And it involves suicide, which is alien to Islam, and just has it's not based on Islamic teaching at all.
As we learn more about the story of Oz and Natasha, it turns out that Oz was doing some research about the sword and downloaded some Al-Qaeda book. And so he was arrested and held in jail for a few weeks and being interrogated to see if he was a terrorist. And eventually he was let out. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about his character and what happened to him.
Yes. So he downloads. He's researching this idea of weapons used for jihad. And he downloads this Al-Qaeda manual. And then that him arrested. And this actually happened. I read about it in the newspaper. It is actually a case that did take place a couple of years ago, and a student was arrested and then you know, released after a week. And also there is now under counterterrorism policy here in the United Kingdom, you know, lecturers, university lecturers are supposed to report on students who they feel are vulnerable to radicalization. And this has been going on now for some time. And part of the novel explores is how Natasha, who is herself a Muslim, though she's not a practicing Muslim, you know, that she, as an outsider, because she's, you know, half African, she volunteers to report these students or to write reports about vulnerable students deemed vulnerable to radicalization. And so she does the training that she does, you know, write reports about the students. So in a way, yes, this part of the novel is a kind of a comment on this, on what is happening now in the UK. And actually this counterterrorism strategy of call, which went here, and there are a lot of criticism because it targets the Muslim community specifically, and it asks and teachers feel that they are, you know, spying on their students. So it's been under, you know, heavily criticized here in the UK. And I wanted to explore how the lecturer herself or himself could be a Muslim. It's not a Muslim reporting on another Muslim. It's not really an us and them a them situation. So it becomes more intriguing.
You're listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. My guest who joined me via Skype is Laila Abolela, author of The Kindness of Enemies.
Can you read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influenced you as a writer?
Yes, I've got Anita Desai. This is her novel, Feasting. This is actually the very first paragraph. And it says, on the veranda overlooking the garden, the drive and the gate, they sit together on the creaking sofa swing, suspended from its iron frame, dangling their legs so that the slender feet them. A low round table is covered with a faded cloth, embroidered in the center with flowers. Behind them, a pedestal fan blows warm air at the back of their head and necks. The cane mats, which hang from the arches of the veranda to keep out the sun and dust, are rolled up now. Pigeons sit upon the rolls, conversing tenderly, yet ticks and splatter the stone tiles below, and feathers float torpidly through the air. The parents sit, rhythmically swinging back and forth. They could be asleep, dozing. Their eyes are hooded, but sometimes they speak. So this is Anita Desai, is really, you know, one of my favorite writers. And I love her descriptions of India. And I love her, you know, the way she writes about family life and the way she writes about women's lives. Very, very subtle, you know, very, very gentle, but a lot of, you know, a lot of cleverness and depth. I feel that she sort of speaks to me because in interviews, she spoke about how, you know, she had four children, and she just used to write in all by herself in while the children were at school, and that writing was a private world to her, and that she didn't know any other writers. And that when she moved, you know, she moved in social circles that didn't include any writers, and she would always be thinking of the writing, you know, it would be in her head all the time. And I can very much relate to that because I also, you know, in circles with any writer, and I also, you know, have children, and I also write, you know. I used to write when they were at school. And of course, as Anita Desai says, in her time, there wasn't, you know, all the conferences and the festivals and the, you know, the kind of that write to now workshops and the festivals and all the activity that's going on online. So that now I travel a lot to writers' festivals, and I do, you know, I'm online, you know, catching the news about other writers and so on. So I do have an interaction with other writers, but most of the time it is, as she says, very sort of very private and very much, you know, close to the domestic sort of setting.
Can you read something you wrote that was challenging or tricky or changed a lot from the first draft?
I have a story that changed a lot from the first draft. Even the title changed. The title was at first called Tear Gas, and it ended up being Missing Out. And it was published in Granta magazine. Actually, the first story in the edition. So I was very excited about that. And the change was actually that I flipped the opening into and made it the ending. So in the original draft, the story starts like this. She held the day up with five pegs, and when she morning billowed into afternoon, into night, and marked. When she was away, Majdi no longer found her prayer mat folded on the bedroom's floor. The old tobe she used for praying dropped over it in a coiled heap. She had put them away in her side of the cupboard, folded them neatly on top of each other to await her return. So the story was in the first draft. And then after a couple of pages, after three pages, there is a paragraph. And then the third sentence in that paragraph became the beginning of the story as it was published. So the paragraph in the original first draft read, a bruised ego did not suit Majdi. instead of humbling him, it made him sour, made him anxious. In his first term in London, he wrote letters home announcing that he would not make it, threatening that he would give up and return. And so this, when I read over the first draft, I felt that there was suddenly a lot of energy in that sentence. And so that became the first, that became the beginning of the story as it was published. So the final draft starts off with, in his first term at college in London, Majdi wrote letters home announcing that he would not make it, threatening that he would give up and return. To call him on the phone, his mother made several trips to the central post office in Khartoum, and so on. And the first paragraph in the original comes at the very, very end of the story, and this is actually quite a longish story. It became the last few lines where he's reflecting on his wife having actually left him and went back home, and he says, "Samra had folded the strangely larger. Samra had folded her prayer mat and put it away in her side of the cupboard. She had not needed to take it with her. In Khartoum, there were plenty of other mats with worn, faded patches in those places where people pressed their foreheads and stood with wet feet. Majdi opened the cupboard and touched the smooth velvet material. It stirred in him a childish sense of exclusion, of being left out, like a pleasure he had denied himself and now forgotten the reasons why. She had held the day up with pegs, not only her day, but his day too. Five pegs, and now morning billowed into afternoon, into night unmarked."
Where do you write?
I write in my study. I have a study in our house, and it's facing the north, so that's good because it means that in summer there isn't too much light, because sometimes too much sunshine, you know, gives me headaches and things. So this room is quite dark, and also it's quite small, so it's easy to keep warm in the winter. So it works for winter and summer. Dark and small.
What do you do, or where do you go to get away from writing?
I go to the gym, because I had a lot of strain on my shoulders and neck from the computer many, many years ago. And it panicked me, because I couldn't, there was a time when I couldn't type. And so I have this idea of fitness and keeping fit. And so I go to the gym 4 times a week now.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
I show it to my husband, who's he's my first reader, and he gives me back good feedback. And also because we grew up in Sudan, in the same neighborhood, he also jogs my memories sometimes when I'm writing about something and he remembers it, and he says, and then also this, that, and the other, and so that helps me with my writing.
How have you dealt with rejection?
That's very, very hard. I think it's hard. It doesn't get easier. I think I deal with it by reminding myself that it's not personal.
And what is your favorite word?
My favorite word is inevitable. And I like fiction because of that, because it shows that so strongly, how everything you see, it's not just random. It's actually, there's a lot behind it, and that has built up to this particular moment, a lot of past that has built up to this particular moment. And so how it is, if you're in the know how things are going, then things will make sense to you, and that you will feel that they are inevitable.
You've been listening to First Draft, a dialogue on writing produced at Aspen Public Radio. My guest who joined me via Skype was Lila Abolela, author of The Kindness of Enemies. You can follow First Draft on Facebook. Just look for First Draft on Writing and at First Draft APR. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. Thanks for listening.